are beautiful, we're irrefutable. We are omnipotent, we're militant, resilient, we're autonomous. We are the consequence, we are consciousness.
We are the heartbeat of every freedom fighter who came before us, and all will come after.
Feral. Adjective. Especially of an animal in a wild state after escape from captivity or domestication.
Alcatraz, Arab Spring, 1 billion rising. Freedom schools, the maroons, rebellion thriving. We've been rising since the dawn of creation, sun. In the blood of our veins, liberation runs.
Welcome to Feral Visions, a decolonial feminist podcast brought to you by Liberation Spring. I'm your host, Anjali Nathupathia. We begin with a content note or trigger warning. Here at Feral Visions, we go deep, and that often means courageously addressing white supremacist, imperialist, heteropatriarchal, capitalist, settler, colonial violence in order to support healing and transformation. Bypassing isn't an option. The only way is through. The time for denial is over, and today's a great day to keep it real. Amidst the show's focus on unapologetic truth-telling, then, please practice excellent self and community care while listening.
Where we can all attain emancipation from oppression, break the chains from Haiti to Tibet and worldwide. Don't forget the resistance in our roots and resilience in our breath, in the blood of our veins, liberation runs. We are standing on the shoulders of the ancient ones.
What do food sovereignty and decolonizing diets, both incredibly political and intimate ideas, really look like? Especially since I was raised growing food with my mother, I'm immensely honored to be sharing this dialogue. So many folks who are sincerely seeking solutions to the world's problems are surrounded by diversions and false starts that further injustice in the name of eradicating it. For example, lots of folks are spending countless dollars and time on the Eurocentric, appropriative permaculture movement when they could be supporting indigenous-led, decolonial, land-based education. How about we not perpetuate problems in our attempts at problem-solving? Reconnecting to the land in a decolonial way is vital in this age of climate catastrophe, ecocide, and neocolonialism. Supporting the self-determination of the original peoples of a land base and stewarding the place properly. To aid in our learning about these topics, I'm pleased to be in dialogue with a fellow community-based educator whose project has been extraordinarily nourishing and inspirational for me to volunteer at periodically over the years. Uncle Dean Wilhelm is the co-founder and executive director of Ho'okua Aina, nestled in the Ahupua of Kailua at Kapalai in Mauna Wili on the island of Oahu. This nonprofit organization uses Hawaiian traditions of kalo or taro cultivation to improve the lives of today's youth and build a healthy community. It's a manifestation of Dean and Michelle Wilhelm's vision to create a gathering place for people in the community to connect with and care for the aina or land, perpetuate Hawaiian culture through the cultivation and preparation of kalo, and to be a place that would ultimately bring healing to people, especially at-risk youth. Since 2007, the Wilhelms, along with a hui or group of collaborators and community volunteers, have restored 7.6 acres to be abundant and productive. Today, the lo'i, or wetland taro patch, is an ideal outdoor learning environment for aina-based education. They're literally rebuilding lives from the ground up by empowering youth to realize the meaning and purpose of their lives by helping them develop life strategies and skills through the cultivation of kalo and Hawaiian values-based coaching. And just a heads up, this recording was taken out on the land, so you'll hear some animals and work being done in the background. Uncle Dean, thank you so much again for your time and energy and being willing to share about this amazing project with folks.
Okay.
Can you explain to our listeners a little bit about where we are, please?
So we are, the specific place is called Kapalai, and we are in the district of Kailua, or the Ahupua of Kailua, on the windward side of the island of Oahu in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are right now, and that's the specific place.
How about this lo'i in particular? Can you share with us a little bit about this project?
Yeah, so aloe is a taro patch, and taro was the main staple food for the Hawaiian people. It's a staple throughout Oceania, and also in other places of the world. I think the taro is grown in China, they grow it the most, but I know that in India, a lot of places in Africa, South America now, and it's been introduced into the Caribbean. I hear the Cubans grow a lot, even in Florida, actually. They grow more taro than us here. Mm. But taro was the main staple eaten, and I would argue, I'm probably a little biased, but that the Hawaiians really took the growing of taro to the highest elevation, you know, in the sense of really honing in on that. Unfortunately, today there's not that much, not nearly, it's just a fraction of the amount of kalo that was grown in the old days. And for a number of reasons, it is no longer really the common staple for people here. You know, it's been supplanted by rice, which is a much cheaper carbohydrate to buy and eat, but not as healthy. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this project here started really not because we wanted to be taro farmers or because we felt we needed to, you know, increase the production of taro in Hawaii by any means. We had a garden at home, my wife and I. We always kind of had a garden. We've been married 23 years now. And at one point we started growing kalo. And we actually were not even eating the staple part, the corm of it. We were just using the leaf to make a traditional dish called laulau. And I relate it to kind of the, like there's a Greek dish with the grape leaves, you know, I forget what that's called.
Bulmus, right?
Yeah, and right. So it's similar to that, I guess, in look. But instead we use the taro leaf, which is similar to spinach. And then we'll usually fill it with some type of meat, either pork or chicken or fish or beef. And what happened is we started, every time we'd have enough leaves to pick, it's something you don't just make for your immediate family. You kind of make a bunch, you know, like 50 to 100 for me. If I'm going to go through the process, I want to make a lot. So I call friends over and say, hey, we're making laulau if you guys want to come over. And next thing you know, our carport would be filled with, you know, people there helping to cut. Well, first we'd pick the leaves from the garden and then wash them and prepare the food. And then it takes like about 2.5 hours to steam the laulau up. And then, of course, we eat together, and then I play music. I play Hawaiian music. And so these impromptu kind of music hula parties would take place. And we realized it was such a draw. Like people, they weren't just there to eat laulau, to just fill themselves up with food. They were really there for the social aspect and to make connections. Yeah. And I think for all of us, it felt empowering to like grow our own leaves and food. And to eat that, it just seemed to taste better than the leaves we had to go and buy from, you know, another farm. Or from the store. So we saw it as a real powerful tool to just gather people, and that there was this desire on the part of people in general to just make connections kind of surrounded around the dinner table, you know, and the power of that gathering. Anytime there's a festival around the world, it's really the center of it is food, right? So it's a powerful bringing together of community. I'm a teacher by trade, and I taught in our public school system for almost 15 years, but I taught at-risk kids for the majority of those years. And actually, my last 5 years in the state school system, I taught in the prison. So the school that I was at, we serviced the incarcerated youth, and I taught the incarcerated boys there for 5 years. So that was kind of always my heart, was to teach those kids. And you know, unfortunately, it's mostly Hawaiian kids who are in our system, and you know, relative to the population of, I think Hawaiians are like 20% of the population in Hawaii. You know, the numbers of them incarceration rates are from 60 to 70%. I think it's something that high. So it's skewed, you know. So anyway, I have a heart for my Hawaiian community, and so what I was doing there is actually I had a class that I was teaching, well first I was teaching an English line and having a hard time making connections with a lot of the kids. And so what I started doing is I just cleared an area outside for the kids, and we started growing taro, kalo. Then I brought in literature about that, and we discuss it and talk and learn about the growing of kalo in some Hawaiian culture as a means to do language arts. And then the culminating activity would be us making laulau together, you know, this dish. And I realized that so few of them had ever made that before, never really knew what it was, and that was kind of shocking for me. Mm. But yet when they finished making it, they would eat it and they would share it with others, and they took such pride in it. And so I really saw that as a powerful teaching tool. And so my wife and I, we kind of got this grand idea that, wow, what if we were able to create a space, because we are slowly outgrowing our little garden area and space. What if we were able to have a gathering place that we could bring community in, you know, particularly, you know, the challenge, whatever you want to term it, at-risk kids. And, you know, by the way, that's a big group, you know. Mm-hmm. We tend to think of them only as the kids who get maybe locked up, but at-risk kids are everywhere, and they're in private schools, and they're affluent kids too. Mm-hmm. So it's a broad spectrum. But what if we created a space that people could make connections, not only to other people, but now start to connect to the land and the food there that is being grown, as well as the cultural connections, you know. And whether Hawaiian or not, we all stem from someplace. And the goal here is to try to have people take pride in who they are and where they come from, you know, and use this as a means, use the host culture and the values as a means to teach. So that was our big idea. And it's a long story as to the journey we took to, you know, eventually sell our house and then purchase this place, and kind of went on this long, you know, exodus journey. But we feel so fortunate to have arrived here, and we were able to purchase this place over 10 years ago. And we're, I guess, in the process of realizing that vision. You know, it has become a gathering place. And ultimately, you know, it's about connecting. We feel that people come here, there's a spiritual connection for many people. And I'm not, you know, whatever that spiritual connection is, I'm not going to define it for you. But, you know, for me, I connect to Keakua, to God, and feel His presence here. But it's also a place to connect and do life differently for people, you know, because life doesn't happen around our food systems here anymore, whereas that's how life really happened, and it still happens in other places of the world. And so it's a different people. The conversations people have in the taro patch are far different than in other areas, and I've noticed that. And so connections are made with people. And then lastly, you know, connections with the land. I mean, we talk about needing to... Now there's this awareness that we've got to like care for the planet, yeah, and we're realizing the limited resources and how we've really, as a human race species, you know, we've really done so many things to harm it, and so it's an opportunity for people to come and take part at least a little, even if it's just a one-time experience, to at least have a mindset that we need to like start to be purposeful in taking action in whatever small ways. To start to care for, you know, at least care for our backyard, our own backyard. And if we can all start to do that, then, you know, we will make an impact. And so that's happening. That's happening here. And we formed a nonprofit about 7 years ago to sustain ourselves. So I was able to step away from teaching in the schools. This was 3.5 years ago, so it's relatively new. You know, we've been building this place out from day one, kind of on our own energy and effort. And so I actually had a few interns who were here, who worked here longer than us, were getting paid before me. You know, we had gotten a grant to pay interns, but never to pay myself. And my wife has only been working for 2 years now, actually. But so most of it was just kind of, you know, pro bono, I guess, but to really get it going forward. And now we feel like we're in a really good place. We found so much support, and that support seems to be growing. So we feel very thankful for that. And excited as to possibilities not only here, but, you know, partnering up with other organizations, because it's not just about the success of what we do here, but it's about collaborating with other like-minded organizations and people so that we can make a collective impact. Because that's the only way that we're going to survive and flourish, is if collectively there are more and more places like this. And that's how we're going to be able to change paradigms, I believe, within the way we think and the way we do life. You know, simple things like, how can you support what we do here? Well, you can start to change your palate a little bit. You know, I tell people that, what if you know, we eat 21 meals a week, roughly, give or take. What if we ate just like three? Three of those 21 meals, you incorporate a little bit of taro into it. You can cook it sweet, you can cook it savory. But what if you just started to change your palate and you took a purposeful mindset to, I'm going to eat some kawa, and everybody did that, you know, then it would, of course, increase the demand, and then taro farmers would be more encouraged, and you'd see more things happening. So you don't need to necessarily do this every day to support that kind of paradigm, and that's what we're really trying to do here. And those connections and everything, it's really so that individuals will come. Ultimately, you know, we want these connections to be made so that first it starts with the individual, so that there's a greater sense of well-being for the individual, which means collectively it's a greater sense of well-being in our community. And that's really what it's about. So well-being is, I think, the bottom line. And Hawaii is a beautiful place. We're blessed to live here. It has changed tremendously, and it's changing as we speak real fast, in ways that I don't want to see it change. And so it's an opportunity to push back and to ground people in values. And to me, it doesn't matter if you're Hawaiian or not. If you now call Hawaii home and you're invested here, then there's certain values that we should all hold dear to us, and we should all be purposeful in living out. So that's, I guess, a larger mission here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, beautiful. Thank you for sharing. I'm so struck by your telling the story of transitioning from working in the sort of mainstream educational system mm-hmm. as a teacher to then holding space for this kind of education.
Yeah.
And I don't know that connection is quite clear to folks that haven't been able to learn from and with the land in community in a way that's nourishing, encapsulating all that you just spoke to, that's so profound and so necessary. If you ask me, could you please talk a little bit more about the educational component of how you see this project?
We work with school groups, and of course, that's who we want to touch, and they have the greatest stake at it because it's their future. You know, I mean, anybody my age and older who doesn't get what we're doing here, I don't waste my time with, because we're going to be phasing out sooner than later. It's the next generation and the young kids who I just need to be shrewd with my time and energy, and so that's who I focus on. But when it comes to that mindset of, yes, I think this, again, I don't want to fault people for just being disconnected, because we live in that world, and you know, I've grown in my connections, and so I can't say that I'd be where I'm at today had we not chosen this path. So I don't fault people for that, but I do challenge, and I do my best to encourage those who, you know, who live their lives as an example. For most of the greater part of American society, people live, and even here in Hawaii now, we have the best climate in the world, but people are living more and more in climate-controlled houses. They walk into their garage that's closed, into their climate-controlled car. They drive to work, get out and in the building, and work in a climate-controlled office for the better part of their day, jump back in their climate-controlled car to go back to their climate-controlled house. Some people, I don't even know if they notice whether it's sunny or if it's rainy or if there's how cold it is, what direction the wind blows, let alone ever contemplated the food that they're eating, that it actually has to be grown someplace, and that people have to put a lot of care and effort into the growing of food, that it takes a tremendous amount of energy to do that. The larger proportion of society lives in that world. Can we fault them? I don't think we can, but I think we should definitely challenge that and encourage getting connected to place, understanding that there's this process of food, and that, you know, it's more than a commodity. And I think that that's what it has become. You know, the growing of food has become a commodity. And I think when you had small farmers, they took pride in what they grew, because they knew the people who they were feeding. So they took pride in the apples that they grew. Mm-hmm. Or whatever it was, because there's that one-to-one connection. But when you don't know where your food is or where it even comes from, there's no pride necessarily in the growing of it, because you could care less who grows it. It's just what you just want to get the highest value, monetary value off of that food. And as the consumer of it, you don't give a rip what kind of conditions they worked in to grow the food. Mm-hmm. You just want to get it as cheap as you can, mm-hmm. as fresh and cheap and good as you can. So we're in this system that we really don't care much about either end of the spectrum. So when there's no aloha there, it's hard to live in that value mindset. And so I think it is important for decision makers in the business world, who are the finance people and the boardroom people, to start to make connections. If they are shaping the future, you know, for me, I can't I'm not even going to talk about the world and where the world's going. My stake is here in LA. So, and again, what CNN plays and what Trump said today, or what I follow it, but I could really care less. What matters for me most is what happens here. And so when it comes to the leadership here, or the decision makers here, it's challenging them. It's challenging them to understand these types of things that for me are imperative. And it's something that unless there's a collective voice articulating that in unison, we're just, you know, this is kind of a nicety. Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of education. Oh, how nice. Right. My kids went, you know, the kids mm-hmm. went to the tarot branch. And got to see how those Hawaiians way back when right. kind of did things like we went to a museum or something. Mm-hmm. That's not what this is about.
Yeah.
This is about using this as an example of what was, what can be, and what should be in the future, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And not everybody thinks the same way I do. And sure. that's okay.
Sure.
You know, it's curable. we can cure that. You
know? Right.
So we shouldn't give up hope. Mm-hmm, and so that's really, you know, our approach. We provide an opportunity, whether it comes to young kids, first grade, or whether it comes to a retiree who's come home after, like this one woman who's right. lived on the mm-hmm. Hawaiian, Honani, yeah, who grew right. up in the mainland, who now comes home and wants to just connect to her place. Mm-hmm. It's powerful. Mm-hmm. And that's why she's here. Mm-hmm. So she's been educated as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I refer to this as the modern day classroom.
Yes. And
this is the cutting edge classroom right
yes,
here.
Yes, right. Exactly. Thank you for that.
And that's my, a person once shared that, and I said, I went up to them after they shared, this is the modern day classroom. They were at another place. Mm-hmm. I asked her if I could, if she had coined the term, if I could use it. So I asked permission.
You're going to have to cite her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I asked permission. So this is what we refer to as the modern classroom, though.
Right.
Yeah.
And it sure does seem so connected to broader necessities in terms of, say, food sovereignty or decolonizing diets, taking it back to wellness, like you spoke to. Could you talk maybe a little bit about either of those pieces?
I mean, it's all connected.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of things. And so food sovereignty, you know, why don't we eat the food that grows here? Why were Hawaiians able to grow all of their food and we feel like there's no way we can grow our own food here? Like there's tracts of land that nobody wants to grow food, and it's because it's been commodified, mm-hmm. and it's just seen for the dollar value, mm-hmm. As opposed to seeing there's if we look at the, you know, I don't know who it was, probably the Stanfordian people of the world who came up with the triple and now the quadruple bottom line. Yeah,
right.
If we start to see value not only in economics but the social, the environmental, and now the cultural value, growing food in our area covers all of that. And if I believe I'm sure there's some kind of spreadsheet that could figure it out that the actual value in that far exceeds using that tract of land to build homes on, mm-hmm. because that's the only mindset that people today, decision makers, business makers have when they look at land, because they only see that as the way they can derive value from that piece of land. And it's so completely contrary to the way our kupuna, our ancestors, saw the value of land. In the land was life. Yeah, mm-hmm. Ua mau ke e oka ina kupuna. Mm-hmm. The life of the land is perpetuated in righteousness, or in doing right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we do right and we care for the land, that's where the strength comes from. But we don't have that mindset anymore. And the dominant mindset is, it's just, you know, so you have guys who are making decisions on large tracts of land who've never set foot there. They just have this map, or they Google it, or I don't know how they make their decisions. They have no clue, but it's just a commodity. Mm-hmm. And it's who can be the shrewdest, mm-hmm. most aggressive to develop it. And so, hence, we have this food system that we're completely dependent upon food coming from the outside, because it's far cheaper to grow, at least right now. Mm-hmm. You know, but the price of fuel and everything goes up, or if there's political right. crisis or unrest in other places, who knows? And then we're going to be like Puerto Rico, as mm-hmm. an example. If there's a mm-hmm. big catastrophe, mm-hmm. heaven forbid, a nuclear fallout with North Korea
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
What if that? I mean, that's going to disrupt a lot of people, mm-hmm. or it could potentially do that. Mm-hmm. What happens then? Because
right.
you know, right now we think, oh, we'll just get the mats in, they'll keep bringing. Well, if there's disruption there, they're going to take care of themselves first.
Right.
Before they take care of Hawaii. So we're in a very precarious place, but yet we live kind of in this matrix world of, you know, we're going to, food's going to always be on at Costco. If I, you know, it's always going to be on the shelves. There's still places in the world where you go to the stores, no more food on the shelves. You got to hustle to get there to just buy the food. But we have no concept of that. And if the apples are on the shelves, they all need to be the same, you know?
Right.
You know, if your apples, oh, this apple's too sour. You know, this one's too ripe. It's too sweet. It's mushy already. You know, we're so spoiled.
Right.
So food sovereignty, really needing to take responsibility for our own well-being, in the sense of needing to first be aware that that's the case here, and then start to take collective efforts. Because if it is a value, then it should be a value that's supported from the top down. It should be a tax incentive. I don't know. I don't have the mindset of how you create incentives, but there should be ways to be able to do that so that we're not incentivized. Food sovereignty is one. You know, we just got to take control. And then the colonization of, you know, I forget, you put it really
the diet,
well.
Decolonizing diet,
yeah.
Right.
So, like, for me, Spam is, like, the ultimate in, like, colonization. And when I have so many Hawaiians who just, like, it's like they want to relish that as if that was, that's, like, Hawaiian or something. It just boggles my mind. It's a colonized mindset of eating food that has been processed for us because it's cheap. And then making that become our staple food, that then becomes the comfort food, that then becomes the food that we then crave. And it's quite tragic when it's like that, when it's rice. And, you know, the Spam musubi is like the ultimate in. And, you know, I don't know what they put in Spam, but, I mean, it must be like drugs or something, because I could, it's like TV. I mean, I could sit dumbfounded in front of a TV for like 4 hours like this. I'm like anybody else. I could also eat a Spam musubi like anybody else every day. I don't know. Again, there's like some kind of drug in there that makes me want to eat it. But we have to like make choices, yeah, to be smart. And and just say no, I guess. I don't know. What is it? See it like, you know, see it like a drug. Just say no. You know, the boob tube, as Jack Johnson calls it,
right,
for the TV. And... and the can of Spam.
Right.
And so I think the key to it is really is educating. And then, you know, you have to provide other alternatives, because you're swimming uphill if people, if they're clueless, you know. So one of the cool things that I do here is with Ulu. We have Ulu, and, you know, Ulu is another staple. It wasn't as big of a staple here in Hawaii as in other parts of Oceania. Ulu is actually more of a staple in the rest of Oceania than it was in Hawaii. And again, that's because I attribute it to we have really well-watered lands, constant year-round, very rich in water. And we have the plains to grow tremendous amounts of kalo relative to coral atolls and other places. So that became the dominant culture here, and hence kalo superseded Ulu, which, again, in other places, it's Ulu is the dominant. But Ulu is like, it's like a no-brainer. You plant the tree and it makes, like, some people say, like, between 3 to 1,000 pounds of ulu in a season, in a year, for doing nothing. It's an awesome starch. It's a complex carbohydrate. Everyone should have an ulu tree in their backyard, as far as I'm concerned. But nobody knows how to eat it. We Hawaiians, I'm just going to speak on behalf, as a Hawaiian, on behalf of Hawaiians, we've forgotten how to eat ulu. It's really sad. And Hawaiians will let ulu fall, or they'll just give it away to other you know, ethnic groups here, Samoan, Tongan, Micronesian, as if it's, you know, like rubbish food. Talk about being colonized, you know. They still understand the value in it. And so so one of the things I do here is I'll pick an ulu off of a tree for kids, and I'll take it and I'll cook it in a wok, and I'll make with oil. And so it's not the traditional way to cook it. It's not the healthiest way. But man, it lights up some eyebrows, I can tell you that, because when I make ulu chips, everybody, I don't care who you are, everyone loves the ulu chips. I haven't had one person who's eaten and go, I don't like that at all. I mean, I think it's way better than French fries. So just being aware, and so just demonstrating that this is it. I could, like, I'm picking it off the tree. If 5 minutes later, I'm cutting it. It's in the oil, and you're eating it within less than 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like, talk about fast food. That's faster than driving from here to McDonald's, getting French fries, and coming back home.
Thank you.
So I think, you know, a part of it is education. We need to teach people, like, the resources we have and the possibilities we have. Like, if you grow a tree 5 years from now, it's going to take about 4 to 5 years. You're going to have, like, plenty ulu. And you can eat it 1,000 different ways, sweet or savory, like taro. And what if you started to incorporate that in 3 meals? Mm-hmm. So you start to incorporate kalo for 3 meals and ulu for 3 meals. Mm-hmm. It's still not even a third of the meals we eat a week, just as a kind of a baseline to just start that out. So I'm conscious of that myself. And, you know, we've gotten to the point where I don't think about it anymore. I mean, it's just a part of our normal diet. I'm eating food from here, I'd say, more than half the time. You know, I have a wide palate. My dad was from Europe. He was a chef. I was introduced to all kinds of culinary onos, you know, and I'm probably going to continue to eat other foods. So I don't know that, say, in my grandparents' days, if you grew up just eating poi every day, I could eat poi every day if that's all I had. But if I can change up, I'm going to change up. And we have that. That's the exciting thing with today. We have that, those possibilities. But so I'm being realistic in a sense. You know, I don't eat poi every day or ulu, but... again, what if we ate half of our meals? We had kalo, ulu, sweet potato, or bananas. To me, I'm convinced that here in Hawaii, we could be food sufficient if we grew those four things and were purposeful in eating those. Because those you can also then feed to the pigs, yeah? And then you can get your own meat. Mm-hmm. And then supplement that with other greens that can be grown here. We don't need to be eating kale from California, but we can grow our own kale for that matter. But there's other things and greens and healthies that can grow right here that we can source right here. So it's very doable. We have the best climate to grow food all year round. It's just a matter of the will of the people. And there's not that will yet, but I believe it's growing. And so I'm hopeful to address those two things, food sovereignty and the decolonization of our diets.
Yeah, thank you for
so
that.
So important.
Right. Well, around the spam musubi example, which is such a good example, because food is so intimate for people.
Yeah.
It's so personal because we have the stories of gathering with our family, and it's associated with memories of holidays and special occasions.
Yeah.
How do you deal with something like some folks having become addicted to spam, for example?
Yeah.
It's funny, but it's also so serious, right?
No, it is.
Yeah.
I remember it was powerful. Once I was in New Zealand, and I was at a, it was for the what's called WIPSI conference, which stands for the World Indigenous
People's Education
Conference.
Oh,
you got it.
Great conference, right?
Yeah, so it's down there, real powerful. And there was this, I happened to go to this one dinner I got invited to. I was stoked to be there. And there was this family of, they were performers, Maori. So they would sing and kind of, they would do dances and songs, and they would narrate throughout. And they came to this one point where they narrated, and it was the father, he was old, and he had his sons and daughters or daughters-in-law, and he started doing this kind of like powerful kind of haka. I tear up even today just thinking about it, but he started, the whole thing was like, why do we get upset that we have diabetes in our family? Nobody forces the fork into my mouth. Yeah, why do we do this when, you know, it's basically, no blame anybody. You know, we want to blame them or spam or anybody else for our diabetes and our health. Nobody shoves that food down your throat. So you know what? Start to take personal responsibility, in other words. You know, and I'm to that point too. I'm over other Hawaiians talking about Hawaiians being on the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder and the most incarcerated and all the health problems. I'm sorry, but I'm very tired of hearing that. We have to take personal responsibility because nobody is going to take responsibility for us. People can help us, they can support us, there can be all these programs and everything like that. But if you in AA, yeah, you're struggling with alcohol, you can go to all the programs you want. But if you choose to just drink a beer at that one time, or you can, and you know what, it's all on you, man. And so I'm over the welfare system mindset of helping our people, because I believe that it has actually caused the colonization, to be quite honest. It's about personal responsibility. And you talk to older Hawaiians, they don't look for the welfare check. That was never something that was a part of their mindset. But yet there's many Hawaiians today, my age and younger, who feel a sense of entitlement because they're Hawaiian, because they've been so wronged in their lives. You know what? It's about taking personal responsibility, everybody choosing. So I challenge people, and I joke around with it. I'll bring it up sometimes when we have groups about, and I'll talk about carbohydrates, complex carbohydrates, and I'll go into this, you know, a complex versus an empty carb, and I'll make a joke out of it about Spam, you know, like, well, I'm glad none of you guys said Spam's a main staple food, you know, because I've heard kids say, what's one staple food, a food you eat every day? Oh, Spam! Like, oh no, brother, we get a hard time for you, I feel for you. And so I'll say, you know what, when it comes to Spam, you guys, you know what, Spam is on special occasion food. Only eat it on Christmas morning. But don't ever eat it any time from that. Just make it a special occasion food. And then I try to bring an awareness to it. And you know, I don't know how impactful that is, but I think it makes people think when you start to say that. And then if I do have time for cooking classes, because if you're talking economics, you got to respect that. I mean, I got four kids, and it's kind of a load when you got to cook for, you know, for six people every day. And, you know, a lot of people who are on the socioeconomic, the bottom of it, a lot of them have big families, you know? So you got to think about food and costs, and it's right there. But I'll often price it out. If I have the time, price out a can of Spam and just a regular piece of pork.
Yeah.
It's cheaper to buy a regular piece of pork, put salt and pepper on it, and fry it for the same amount of time that you fry Spam, and you get a higher quality of food that's doesn't have all of the yuckies in
preservatives,
there, the preservatives, the stuff that's really, really unhealthy for us.
Right.
So I think it's bringing awareness, but then you got to provide, you can't just tell people, no, go eat that and expect they're going to go shop at Whole Foods because they don't want that capacity. Yeah, so I think there's a real disconnect right now. We're not providing alternatives for them to change diet. You have to provide like alternatives for it and give people like a chance. You got to set them up for success, right? So again, if you eat rice 21 meals out of the week, change up, maybe just three. Spend the extra money, buy some kalo. It'll cost you more than rice, yeah? Find some ulu, yeah? Or be purposeful in like asking the neighbor down the street who's not eating ulu, hey, you mind if I just had a couple of ulu off the tree? Most people are going to say, yeah, brother, take one ulu, not a problem, right? If you get plenty, you're not eating them all. Because that's the thing with ulu, you know, ulu, you get one tree, you can't eat them all yourself. You even have a hard time giving them away. So why don't we be more sharing and more purposeful in that?
Right.
And then in turn, you're developing relationship with your neighbor, you know, by inquiring. And then, so instead of 21 meals of rice, you got 18 meals of rice. And you're incorporating ulu. You know?
Slow and steady.
Slow.
Right.
Gotta be slow, but gotta be something we can. You know, because they're not going to shop Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And they're not going, if they haven't ever eaten kale salad before, they're not going to eat kale salad. You gotta break them in slowly. So one of the things I did with kids up at HYCF when it comes to the diet mindset is, we had a garden, so we grew kale and stuff like that, and we cooked all the time. That was my carrot. You know, and have the kids from 8 to like 12:30. So like 4.5 hours. And by 12:30, they're hungry, you know, because it's lunchtime. So we'd cook right before that, yeah. So they hung so. But the rule was that we could eat anything, and we'd bring some other things. We'd make laulau, of course, we'd bring in pork, which we made a lot of. I used to eat plenty laulau because I'd be making like every other week seemed like. Just to keep them jazzed about what they were doing. And as an incentive, if they worked well, got to give them the carrot, yeah. But we would eat other things in the garden. I mean, we grew eggplant and lettuce, broccoli we even grew once. A lot of string beans, cucumbers, tomatoes. And the kids would just tell me straight out, oh, mister, I don't eat that kind of stuff. I never did ever eat an eggplant before. They just tell me straight out, I'm not going to eat that. Okay, but you don't need to eat them. We're going to make them for ourselves. I make them ono, you know. 11:30, not quite lunchtime. We're eating. They're looking at us. They still get half hour before they can go eat lunch. I mean, we're going to try a little bit. Yeah, but just try a little bit. You can try. Oh, not bad. Okay, I can have a little bit more.
Easing their way in, right?
Hey, hunger is a powerful right. Motivator, you know. So if you provide opportunities, like what we'll do here is if I do make that kind of aina food, is I make them over here, and I tell people, don't go bring anything else, like, because, you know, you, as much as people will eat lau lau and luau stew and poi, if there's a whole smorgasbord of, like, you know, chicken katsu and all, and mac salad and all this other kind of stuff, they're going to eat that because that's what they're used to. Mm-hmm. But they come out and only get luau stew and poi. I'm telling you, they're going to eat that and they're going to really enjoy that. And then now it's like, wow, that was so ono. And what we have to start doing, is, especially with Hawaiian food, is it's not a food that should be like a festive occasion. You know, it becomes like, oh, I eat Hawaiian food when, you know, in summertime when I get, you know, my wedding, my all the graduation parties and weddings come up, then I go eat Hawaiian food. Mm-hmm. Well, Hawaiian food, you don't need, most of what you're eating, not Hawaiian food anyway, when you right. go and eat chicken long rice, lomi salmon, rice, is not Hawaiian food. But that's what we've made it become. Hawaiian food is just like cool, I know, like simple, just some luau leaf, stew them up, maybe if you get some fish, put them in. You know, even just put some salt in it and eat that with some chunks of kalo. Mm-hmm. It's very simple. But that's the kind of food that we need to start eating on a regular occasion and introducing people that can.
Yeah, making foods that are ancestrally meaningful, not just a special occasion, and when you're going to do the thing, doing the thing. So is that even, whether it's here, Hawaiian food to begin with,
Like
it's associated with Hawaiian food, or like on the continent, fry bread is American Indian food, where it's like, really, white flour? Was that lard? Really? Come on now.
Yeah, I don't understand that mindset. Yeah. So, and I guess they got to spam.
Sure.
Epidemic going on there too in most of, in many of the
reservations
from what I've heard.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there was this local kid who was at school over here at Kalaheo, and he said he and his friend went up and they started doing like spam musubis somewhere in like Arizona or someplace like that. Said, yeah, we got this spam musubi business and we've opened up a couple of restaurants here and there. I'm like, what? Spam musubi? Like, we'll get that many locals up there? They're like, no, on the reservations, bro.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, here he is a young guy, you know, entrepreneurial, making some, going, oh, brother, like, I kind of didn't know how to end the conversation with him.
Right.
I wasn't, you know, real stoked on it.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that's part of the point of these conversations for me is so many folks have energy and, you know, maybe are entrepreneurial, but they haven't quite thought through haven't quite gotten all the feedback that might be helpful to really ensure that they're having a good impact.
Yeah, and that's what it's about, right? It's the impact. And so, again, it's changing the mindset that if what we're doing isn't, like, beneficial and making a positive impact, then maybe we should really think through whether we should do that or not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And this is because everybody's driven by the dollar value, and if we generate dollar values, then we must be doing something good, right? Is the mindset. So completely contrary to, you know, living pono.
You know, around that idea of having a good impact, I'm sure that this space has been so healing for so many folks. Could you share maybe any observations or reflections that you've had about the kind of impact that being able to come here and learn here and contribute to this place has had for folks?
We've had reflections, and, you know, we've had thousands and thousands of people come through here. And it's really amazing because, you know, I'll do a little talk story and teaching, and, you know, sometimes I joke around and just kind of have fun so that the group, you know, gets an experience. But I gotta say that most of what I would say, most of the impact that people have doesn't come from any of what I do. It just comes from being here. It's the land that impacts people, the setting, the place, maybe the camaraderie, the, you know, there's a lot of factors I think that come into it. And I don't often get to hear, you know, the stories, but we have heard stories of people like just welling up in tears of coming and jumping in the mud. And I bet if you were to ask that Hawaiian auntie who left today, have her sit down and like, so share with me, what did you feel today? I mean, you're going to open a floodgate of emotions, guaranteed.
Yeah.
That right now, even she's probably not even able to process at the time. Yeah.
Sure.
And I think there's a lot of people who come through here who weren't able to process a lot of those things. You know, and I would say for myself as an example, I once went to Ka'ala Farms out in, this is in Waianae, 22 years ago, and sat there, and there's a gentleman by the name of Eric Enos. There's not too many guys who I'd call them like my heroes, but he's one of them. And he was there talking about, he was here, it was a Saturday, he was talking to educators. I was kind of his group. I happened to just go with my sister. She told me to come tag along. And I just recently moved home, and I was a little disconnected. I'd gone off to school for 4.5 years, and I lived in Europe for a couple of years. Come home, and just was trying to get my life going when my wife and I had recently married and going through some stuff. And so I was just focused on me, myself, and I. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't looking at big picture. And out there, and he started talking about these things, and he was pounding poi, and that's actually the first time I had seen it done. Mm. But I knew he hadn't actually pounded before, but there was an older Hawaiian man who he was pounding with, and I had met the Hawaiian man before because he was my grandmother's contemporary. They were from Mililii, a small fishing village. And so I knew he was the real deal, old Kanaka. Mm-hmm. The other guy was kind of a generation who hadn't had it but was pounding the kalo. And he was talking, like, to me it was like this crazy talk, you know, and I had gone to Kamehameha schools and was a proud graduate, and he had gone as well, and he was saying stuff like, yeah, but Kamehameha schools, that's not a Hawaiian school. It's a school for Hawaiians, but I never learned nothing Hawaiian at that school. Started talking about, yeah, and then Kamehameha schools, they got this and this and that land, but how come get all these other Hawaiians this and that, and they're not helping them? So at first I was like, hey, who's this punk talking bad about Kamehameha schools, you know? Mm-hmm. Then as the day went on, I realized, everything this guy is saying is true. And he completely switched my whole paradigm. And that day was a powerful experience. And when I look back now, I attribute much of what we're doing now to that one time experience. Mm. So, here, how are we impacting people? Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, because, you know, we gotta, as a nonprofit, we gotta gather data and be able to, you know, show our funders that all these wonderful things are happening and we're making this tremendous impact. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I can't quantify that.
Right.
You just can't add it all up. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I know we're making an impact, and I know it's deep, and we are doing a lot. Please know that we're working really hard to collect that information, to gather it, to synthesize it, and to share that out in ways more than just talking story. Mm-hmm. And we're working hard on that. We're really putting an effort into that because we believe that we need to demonstrate impact so that the larger world out there understands that there's amazing things taking place, and so that these places are not, again, just niceties.
Right.
So that they're seeing as, like, this should be a vital part. This should be a common part of the education for every student in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people who think like that. Mm-hmm. But until we can collectively demonstrate that, you know, on paper, you know, graph some, whatever, you know, whatever those guys need to see,
right,
until we can articulate that to them and they can understand it, they're not going to support it.
Mm-hmm.
But once we can start to get good at that, then we can start to shift and get more and more support in that arena. So we are working hard, and I don't want to undermine that. My wife would really scold me. But how can I demonstrate that type of impact?
Mm-hmm.
Like my experience at Ka'ala 22 years ago
is
what I'm doing today.
Right.
That's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I trust, because that's happened to me, I trust that that's happening here as well.
Right.
And I know it's happening because people have said things to that extent.
Mm-hmm.
To myself, to... Mm-hmm. Oh my, we hear it. We hear it all the time. And if we were to really have the time and money, we could hire on 10 people to talk to people and trace them for 5 years and track them, and you know, that's what it takes. That's what they're looking for. Well, what about the kid? These kids who come in, where were they at? And were they? Well, where are they in 5 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
Give me $5 million so I can hire people to track that. You know, if you want me to spend all my energy doing that, I kind of do this.
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of that. We gotta push back a little bit, you know, and
let them know. Sure.
Let them know that it's tough gathering that information.
Right. And the impact isn't all, it's intangible so often, or
yeah,
it's not immediately apparent, and not everything is quantifiable.
No, no. But we are working in that direction. And so I just can leave that with you.
Right. Anything you'd want to share about projects moving forward or a vision of expansion at this point?
Moving forward, we're running out of land to clear, so maybe we got to find more land.
Mm-hmm.
We've always seen this as, we knew that a part of our mission is to really put our hands on the plow and create this gathering place. We didn't really create it, but to facilitate the creation of a gathering place like this. We want to do the best job we can so that when people come here, just from being here, you know, like for a lot of the the at-risk kids who come here are, a lot of them, we got a bunch of kids, I got a group from Farrington. These kids all live in the housing out there.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see greenery.
Yeah.
But they're all like from Samoa and
right.
Tonga mm-hmm. and Micronesia.
Right.
They come here and I know just being here, just coming onto the aina, that is a paradigm changer.
Yeah.
You know? So we've always felt that if we could provide that type of place and that we could, that this would be used as an inspiration mm-hmm. for other people, other areas. And with that, that would then provide greater opportunities. Not necessarily for ourselves, we got plenty to do here.
Sure.
But for these types of, this movement to continue on. So that's where it's really at. And I think for 2018, one of our major goals is to do a lot more collaboration mm-hmm. with other organizations.
Mm-hmm.
To, before you can start to collaborate and do work with them and start to create this collective voice and movement to link arms and to really so that we are a movement and we define ourselves as such and it's laid out, we've got to build relationship first. So you have to be very intentional. You have to spend time and energy, and that's a lot of resources doing that, which we weren't able to do in the past. And we could probably still be here and still be here. There's plenty to do, but we want to be more purposeful and say, no, we're going to meet up like with these guys. Mm-hmm. They're going to come over and mm-hmm. we're going to go to other sites. And this, just in the talking, you're around the people who are, they're doing different work. They're doing fish pond. We're doing the same work because
mm-hmm.
it's really not about the growing of kalo.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, it's not about the growing of fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's about growing the well-being of our community. That's the goal. That's the big goal.
Right.
They're doing it in their means. We're doing it in our means, but mm-hmm. we're linking up.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the things moving forward that mm-hmm. we are jazzed about. And then raising up our hui. We've got an amazing crew here and raising them up so that they understand the tremendous leadership capacity that they have
mm-hmm.
and them stepping into that.
Mm-hmm.
So really raising up our little special forces army here.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way we see it. We'd rather go deeper and have a small crew of special forces than have a whole brigade.
Mm-hmm.
That's our analogy. I mean,
sure.
Going to war, I use that as we're going to battle.
Yeah.
And that's how we see ourselves being successful. So that's kind of some of the, that's on our to-do and on our projection list for this year. Continue to do what we do, getting better at it. We keep saying we're going to limit the amount of people, we're going to kind of, but last year, I think we had 16 school groups, and we said, okay, that's it. And I think this year we got 48 school groups. I don't know how that happened. And then, finding the balance too, making sure we don't kill ourselves in the process, and taking time for our own well-being, because it takes a lot of energy to work with people and groups, and just being aware of that. And I think we're pretty good. I think my wife and I, she works really, really hard. She's working really hard right now. She's got three grants she's writing, a couple end-of-the-year reports, and it's right during the holidays where we wanted to kick back.
Right. Well, thank you so much for everything that you shared. If folks want to support the project in any kind of way, how could they get in touch or get involved?
Well, you could go online and check out the name of our organization. It's Ho'okua'aina. So mm-hmm. I know it's a long tongue twister. It's Ho'okua'aina. Ho'okua'aina.org and check us out. I mean, there's a host of ways that you can help us out, from coming and doing a community day here to, eat poi. Come mm-hmm. buy poi, if you're here on Oahu and you're in the neighborhood. Buy raw kalo.
Mm-hmm.
Start to eat. And if you're not buying from us, just eat kalo.
Mm-hmm.
Eat from other people, make it a part of your diet. Of course, if you've got a cool $1 million in your back pocket and you think we're worthy of it, we won't say no. But there's ways
sure.
that you can be a part of supporting us financially as well. So there's a
mm-hmm.
they can peruse through that and decide.
Sure. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time and energy and everything that you've shared and for this incredible work that you're doing here.
Oh, mahalo.
You just heard from Uncle Dean Wilhelm at Ho'okua'aina. Now, I know this conversation may have evoked curiosity for you. What were the staple foods of your ancestors historically? What were the staple foods of the peoples of the land base where you currently live if you're a settler? Are there any current threats to your ancestral foodways or to those of the areas where you're currently located? Wherever you're tuning in from, are there land-based projects that the folks native to that place are working on that you could be supporting? I hope this dialogue inspires you to find out. If you'd like to learn more about the topics that Uncle Dean and I discussed, check out liberationspring.com for our upcoming class titled Kitchen Counterintelligence. All the course materials will be available for free on the site, and you're welcome to apply for our online class from anywhere in the world. Freedom is ours,
yeah. Freedom is ours. That's it for today's episode of Feral Visions, a decolonial feminist podcast brought to you by Liberation Spring. I've been your host, Anjali Nathupadia, and I thank you for listening. I'm also curious to know what this dialogue evoked for you. I invite you to post your reflections and questions in the comments section below to continue our collective journey of unlearning, remembering, and imagining. If you want to share feedback, such as segment ideas or potential guests you'd like to hear on the show, email liberationspring@gmail.com. And don't forget to follow Feral Visions on SoundCloud or iTunes, where you can find our show archive. If you'd like more information on this show's topic or to donate to the project, check out liberationspring.com. Thanks to Catherine Petru and Nicole Gervasio of our technical production team and Climbing Poetry for our theme song. Be sure to tune in for next week's episode. And in the meantime, let's make our ancestors proud. The power of the people is louder than the evil, deceitful and coward. People in power, all power to the people. It's the hour of the peaceful. Freedom is ours, yeah. Freedom is ours.